There can be no doubt on which side my darling daughter stands. After all, Sean, you are talking to a senior member of the Commission for the Reinstatement of the Inuit people to their traditional lands. She smiled at him sweetly. Not Inuit, Papa. People will think you're going soft. Not even Eskimos. Your usual description is gooks, isn't it? Ricardo smoothed back the thick waves of silver at his temples. Shall I tell you how my daughter and her commission go about determining how much of Alaska belongs to the Inuits? He asked. He's going to tell you anyway, Claudia leaned across to stroke her father's hand. It's one of his party routines. It's very funny. You'll love it. Ricardo went on as though she hadn't spoken. They go down 4th Street in Anchorage. That's where all the bars are. And they grab a couple of Eskimos that are still on their feet. They put them on an aeroplane and fly them down the peninsula, and they say to them, Now, tell us where your people used to live. Show us your traditional tribal hunting grounds. How about that lake over there? Did your people fish there once upon a time? Ricardo changed his voice. He was an excellent mimic. Sure, says the Eskimo in the back seat, squinting out the window, his eyes full of Jack Daniels. That's where my grandpappy fished. He changed voices, imitating Claudia. And what about those mountains over there? The one which we wicked white folk who stole it away from you called Brooks Range. Did your grandpappy ever hunt there? He changed to his Eskimo intonation. Sure did, man. He shot a whole mess of bears there. I remember my grandmommy telling me about it. Go on, Papa. You've got a marvelous audience tonight. Mr. Courtney is enjoying your wit hugely. Claudia encouraged him. You know something? Ricardo asked. Claudia has not yet had an Eskimo turn down a lake or a mountain she's offered him. Isn't that something else? My little girl has got a perfect score, never a single refusal. You are just plain lucky, Capo, Sean told him. At least they might leave you something. Here, they took the lot. Claudia woke to the clink of crockery outside the flap of her tent and Moses' polite cough. Nobody had ever brought her tea in bed before. It was a luxury that made her feel marvelously decadent. It was still pitch dark and icy cold in the tent. She could hear the crackle of frost on the canvas as Moses opened the flap. She'd never expected it to be so cold in Africa. She sat up in the camp bed with a quilt over her shoulders, cupping her hands around the tea mug, and watched Moses fussing about the tent. He poured a bucket of hot water into her wash basin and set a clean white towel beside it. He filled a tooth mug with boiled drinking water and squeezed toothpaste onto her brush for her. Then he brought a brazier of burning charcoal and placed it in the center of the tent. "Too cold today, Donna."
And too damned early, Claudia agreed sleepily.
Did you hear the lions roaring last night, Donna?
I didn't hear a thing, she yawned.
They could have had a brass band playing America the Beautiful beside her bed without waking her.
Moses finished laying out her clothes on the spare bed. He polished her boots until they shone.
You want something, Donna? You call me, he told her as he backed out of the tent flap.
She shot out of the warm bed and stood over the brazier, shivering, while she held her panties over the coals to warm them before pulling them on. The stars were still shining when she left the tent. She paused to look up, still amazed by the jeweled treasure chest of the southern sky. She picked out the great cross with a sense of achievement, and then went back to the campfire where the men were and held her hands out gratefully to the flames.
You haven't changed since you were little, her father smiled at her. Do you remember how I used to battle to get you out of bed to go to school every morning?
And a waiter brought her a second cup of tea.
Sean whistled, and she heard Job start the Toyota and drive it around to the front gate of the stockade, and they began pulling on their heavy gear, jerseys and anoraks, caps and woolen scarves. When they trooped out to the hunting car, they found the rifles in the racks, and Job and Shadrach, the two Matabeles, standing in the back, with a little Indorobo tracker between them. The tracker was a childlike figure who came only to Claudia's armpit,
but he had an endearing wrinkled grin and bright mischievous eyes. She had been predisposed to like all the black camp staff, but Matatu was already her favourite. He reminded her of one of the dwarves from Snow White. The three blacks were bundled up against the cold in army surplus greatcoats and knitted balaclava caps, and they answered Claudia's greeting with white grins in the darkness. All of them had fallen under her spell. Sean took the wheel, and Claudia sat on the front seat between him and her father. She crouched down behind the windscreen and cuddled against Papa for warmth. In the short time she had been on safari, she had come to love this start to the day's adventure. They drove slowly over the winding, bumpy track, and as the night retreated before the advance of dawn, Sean switched off the headlights. Claudia peered into the Cumbretum forest and down to the grassy glades that intersected it, that Sean called Flace, trying to be the first to spot some elusive and lovely creature. But always Sean or her father murmured first, "Kudu on the left," or "That's a reedbuck," or Matatu leaned over them from the back to tap her shoulder and point out a rarer sight with his tiny pink-palmed hand. The dusty track was pocked with a spoor of the animals that had crossed in the night. Once they came across the fresh droppings of an elephant still steaming in the chill of dawn, a knee-high pile which everybody climbed out of the Toyota to examine closely. At first Claudia had been disconcerted by this avid interest in dung, but now she was accustomed to it. "Old beggar," Sean said, "on his last set of teeth."
"How do you know that?" she demanded.
"Can't chew his food," he replied. "Look at the twigs and leaves in the dung, almost whole." Matatu was crouched by the spoor, examining the great round footprints, the size of dustbin lids. "See how smooth the pads of his feet are," Sean told her. "Worn down, like an old set of car tyres, old and big."
"Is it him?"
Ricardo asked eagerly, and glanced at the .416 Rigby rifle in the gun rack behind the seat. "Matatu will tell us," Sean shrugged, and the little Ndrobo spat in the dust and shook his head mournfully as he stood up. Then he spoke to Sean in piping falsetto Swahili.
"It's not the one we want. Matatu knows this bull," Sean translated. "We saw this one last year down the river. He has one tusk broken off at the lip, and the other's worn down to a stump. He might have once had a magnificent pair, but he's far over the other side of the hill now."
"You mean Matatu can recognize a particular elephant by his footprints?"
Claudia looked incredulous.
"Matatu can recognize a particular buffalo out of a herd of 500, and he'll know that animal again 2 years later just by a glance at the spoor."
Sean exaggerated a little for her. "Matatu isn't a tracker, he's a magician." They drove on with small wonders occurring all around them. A kudu bull, grey as a ghost, striped with chalky lines, maned and hump-backed, his long corkscrew horns glinting in the gloom, slipped away into the forest. A Genet cat caught out from his nocturnal prowling, spotted and golden as a miniature leopard, peering at them with astonishment from the brown grass of the verge. A kangaroo rat hopped ahead of the Toyota. Troops of chittering guinea fowl with waxen yellow helmets on their heads ran through the grass beside the track. And Claudia no longer had to ask, "What is that bird?" or "What animal is that?" She was beginning to recognize them, and this added to her pleasure. Just before the sunrise, Sean parked the Toyota at the foot of a rocky hill that rose abruptly out of the forest, and they climbed out stiffly and took off their heavy outer clothing. They climbed the side of the kopje, 300 feet of steep, uneven pathway, without a pause, and Claudia tried to disguise her ragged breathing as they came out on the summit. Sean had timed the ascent perfectly. And as they reached the top, the sun burst out of the distant forest and lit it all with dramatic colour and brilliance. They looked out over a panorama of forest and glade that glowed with golden grass to other high, sheer kopjes standing like fairy castles, all turreted and towered in the dawn. Other hills were great dumps of black rock, like the rubble left over from the creation. They shed their sweaters, for the climb had warmed them, and even the first rays of the sun held the promise of the noonday heat, and they sat on the front edge of the hill and played their binoculars over the forest below. Behind them, Job laid out the food box that he'd carried up, and in minutes he had a fire going. It had been too early to eat breakfast before they left camp, but now, at the odour of frying bacon and eggs, Claudia felt her saliva flooding. While they waited for their breakfast, Sean pointed out the terrain. "That is the Mozambique border over there, just beyond the second kopje, only 7 or 8 miles from here."
"Mozambique," Claudia murmured, peering through her binoculars. "The name has such a romantic ring to it."
"Not so romantic. It's just another triumph of African socialism and the carefully thought-out economic policy of chaos and ruination," Sean grunted.
"I can't take racism before breakfast," Claudia told him icily.
"All right," Sean grinned. "Suffice it to say that just across the border, there you have 12 years of Marxism, corruption, greed, and incompetence just beginning to bear fruit. You have a civil war raging out of control, famine that will probably starve 1 million people, and epidemic disease, including AIDS, that will kill another 1 million in the next 5 years."
"Sounds like a fun place for a vacation," Ricardo said. "How about breakfast, Job?"
Job brought them plates of eggs and bacon and fried French bread, followed by mugs of strong, aromatic coffee. They ate off their laps, glassing the forest through their binoculars between mouthfuls.
"You're a pretty good cook, Job," Claudia told him.
"Thank you, ma'am," Job answered quietly. He spoke English with only a slight accent. He was a man in his late 30s, with a tall and powerful physique and wide-spaced, intelligent eyes, in the handsome moon face typical of the Matabele and their Zulu origins.
"When did you learn?" Claudia asked.
And the Matabele hesitated and glanced at Sean before he said in his deep, soft voice,
"In the army, ma'am."
"Job was a captain in the Ballantine Scouts with me," Sean explained.
"A captain?" Claudia exclaimed. "I didn't realize that..."
She broke off quickly, looking embarrassed. "You didn't realize there were black officers in the Rhodesian army," Sean finished for her. "There is a lot more to know about Africa than what they show you on CBS television." Shadrach, the second gun-bearer, was sitting 50 yards farther along the crest, where he had a better view towards the north, and now he whistled softly and pointed up that way. Sean wiped the last of the egg yolk off his plate with a toast and stuffed it into his mouth. He passed the plate to Job. "Thanks, Job, that was great," and went to join Shadrach. The two of them peered down into the forest.
"What is it?" Ricardo called impatiently.
"Elephant," Sean replied. And both Ricardo and Claudia sprang up and hurried to join them.
"Where? Where?" she demanded. "Big one?" Ricardo asked. "Can you see his tusks? Is it him?"
"Too far, to be sure. A couple of miles." Sean pointed out the indistinct grey blur among the trees, and Claudia was amazed that such a huge animal was so difficult to see. It took some minutes before it moved slightly and she was able to pick it out.
"What do you think?" Ricardo asked. "Could it be Tukutila?"
"It could be," Sean nodded. "But it's 1,000 to 1 against it."
Tukutila.
Claudia had listened to them discussing this elephant at the campfire. Tukutila, the angry one, was one of those legendary animals of which there were only a handful left in the whole length and breadth of Africa. A bull elephant with tusks that weighed over 100 pounds each. Tukutila was the main reason that her father had come back to Africa for the last time, for he had once seen Tukutila. 3 years before, he'd been on safari with Sean Courtney, and the two of them had followed the great elephant for 5 days. Matatu had led them over 100 miles on the spoor before they had come up with him. They had stalked to within 20 paces of the enormous and ancient beast as he fed on the fruits of a marula tree. They had studied every wrinkle and crease in his riven grey hide. They were so close that they could have counted the remaining few hairs in his tail, the rest worn away over the years, and they had gazed in silent awe upon his ivory. Ricardo Montera would have willingly paid any price to possess those tusks as his own trophy. He'd asked Sean in a whisper, "Isn't there any way I can have him?" And he had seen Sean hesitate before he shook his head.
"No, Capo, we can't touch him. More than my license and my concession are worth."
For around his neck, Tukutila wore a collar, a sturdy thing of nylon, tough as a heavy-duty truck tire, and suspended from it was a radio transmitter.